In the Thick of It, a Profit and Loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Welcome to In the Thick of It, Profit and Loss's weekly podcast with myself, Colin Lambert, Managing Editor of Profit and Loss, and Galen Stobbs, Editor of P&L. Galen, I want to kick off this week with one of your sort of really favourite things, he said in as ironic a voice as he could. A bank has announced like a restructuring and a digitisation programme, and I'm sure there were lots of really hot buzzwords in there. JPM restructuring, what's your thoughts on it?
Yes, so there were kind of a couple of memos that went out, kind of detailing what it was going to look like. The new organization within JPM is called Digital Platforms and Services, and within that, it's broken down into four segments. One is technology, operations, and infrastructure. Another one is data. We've got analytics, artificial intelligence, finance, and business management. Obviously, a lot of the stuff in the memos is very buzzwordy. But what it reminded me of, so one of the people from our world, so obviously Eddie Wen, who was global head of e-commerce for the bank's macro business, which covered FX, EM, rates, and commodities, he's now global head of digital markets. So he's within this digital organization within this. And it reminded me of, do you remember we talked a while ago about Barclays doing that whole digitization initiative?
Yeah.
And we weren't necessarily sure what digitization exactly meant. beyond, you mean like it's all electronic now? I thought it was already electronic. But I think that this is something we're going to see more and more, which is banks talking about, you know, their digital offering. I think e-commerce is out and digital is in, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, to me, I look at it and go, does this mean that their e-ratios go from 88% to 89%? Because I'm not sure I can see the difference between digital and e-commerce, beyond the fact it's a more modern word, a more modern expression. I mean, I think what I would say, what's interesting to me with this is that I think we're starting our process for judging our digital FX awards. And I would point out to the world that we've been using the word digital FX now for 17
before
years.
Before it was cool.
Exactly. Market leaders. But generally speaking, around this, you know, the award process, I mean, JP is last year was, you and I went around and looked at all the platforms and we got all our feedback from users. And JP was 1-2 in most categories on the platform. So they've already got a really strong sort of, you know, EFX or EFIC and franchise, whereas Barclays, I felt, needed to do something to kick it into life from a few years of sort of, you know, moribundness, I guess. So it's interesting that JP are doing this now when, to all intents and purposes, are at the top. I mean, do you think this is just a question of the bank saying, look, we're never going to rest on our laurels, we're going to keep pushing, and we're going to explore as many boundaries as we can?
It certainly could be that. I mean, there's also, to my mind, the extent to which this is actually anything new, right? You know, there's constant reorganizations at all these firms and, you know, oh, it's going to be a FIC business. Oh, wait, no, it's going to be an e-commerce business. Oh, wait, it's going to be just a trading business. And so it's not, with all these restructurings, it's not clear to the extent to which that it's just a restructuring like any other restructuring we've seen, except they've given it the name digital, or what a quote-unquote digital organization, digital structure, digital kind of focus necessarily entails that somehow is different. I mean, yes, you know, there seems to be a focus on analytics and AI within it, but I don't necessarily know what's that much different about it without being privy, I guess, to kind of the strategy meetings where no doubt plenty of strategy meetings where this was conceived.
Yeah, I mean, and I think one thing I would say is that it's one of those strange games everyone has to play, that to get the budget required for that next generation moving on in the e-commerce space, they have to give it a cool name. Because otherwise, you know, the purse string holders are going like, oh, really? Well, we've already paid this business, you know, X amount of millions of dollars to build this. What's wrong with this? And so you can, if you go in there, like, oh, no, we've got a really, you know, crash hot, cool, new digital business, but we need funding. and all of a sudden they get caught up in the hype. I don't know. Maybe it's a bit of that as well. I guess the big question that everybody wants to know, and you're the expert on this, is do you think this is going to lead to an innovation lab?
Well, I don't know if digital businesses are the new innovation lab.
Oh, hadn't thought of that one. Yeah. Because, I mean, we have long enjoyed the fact that, you know, when banks get together and, like, really don't know what to do to make themselves sound cool, they always open an innovation lab.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I've actually seen anything come out of any innovation lab, but there you go. Maybe something, you know, things are coming out of Barclays, so maybe...
I think that we'll see, in the next 12 to 18 months, I think we'll see a bunch more digital groups, digitization efforts.
Yeah.
I think it's going to happen quite broadly now.
Well, and I think also there's this habit that the banking industry does tend to move as a herd still, doesn't it? If something works well. And it does seem to have, you know, rejuvenated the Barclays FIC business, or certainly the FX business. You know, they've got some senior hires coming in. You know, they hired a new head of trading for Asia Pacific this week. So it seems to have worked there. So maybe, yes, I should say, you've got a successful role model, then the rest of them pile through the door. So that's one to watch.
And to be fair to the banks, I mean, they're not the only ones that have this herd mentality. I mean, we're just wrapping up the a special report on the OTC multi-dealer platforms, and, you know, speaking to all of them, it would say, okay, so what were your kind of big initiatives last year, and what are you going to be focusing on this year? We rolled out a data analytics platform. We're going to be focusing on that this year. Yes. Oh, really? You and every other platform out there.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the only good thing is they didn't say we're going to differentiate ourselves through data analytics this year.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's not a bad thing. I mean, that's what their clients are telling them. But, you know, as you say, it all tends to happen in step slightly.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, the clients pretty much are asking for the same thing. This is why I always think it's interesting when you get organisations that are proactive and not reactive. My concern has always been when you get these people get up and they get on stage at our conferences and go, oh, yeah, we listen to our clients, and then, you know, respond accordingly. So in other words, you're reacting. You're not actually leading your clients anywhere. There are times when you have a good idea that you can actually lead the clients, and the clients will go, oh, that's a really good idea. And when it does happen, you'd normally find the bank picks up a chunk of new business. I think the problem is it involves, you know, innovation, not an innovation lab. And interestingly, without an innovation lab, a lot of people seem very afraid in this environment to actually be innovative. I guess you can't blame them. Moving on, still at JP Morgan, actually, they put out their liquidity survey of their clients this week, which you reported on. There were some interesting numbers in there for me. I mean, I think the headline acts that, yeah, liquidity is the biggest concern, shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. But they were also talking in terms of, like, you know, digital initiatives, weren't they, in terms of what's important to those clients?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that was, as you say, the headline was, you know, ask what is the biggest daily issue facing FX traders right now, or certainly first facing traders. There were, to be fair, some rates and commodities traders in this survey, but it's predominantly FX. But 40% of them said that the availability of liquidity was the biggest challenge facing traders right now.
Mm.
And I mean, the next closest thing was, you know, 25% pointed to efficiency of process, 18% best X, 17% price transparency. So it was out ahead of the field by quite some way, which, I mean, you talk about, you know, there is a clear disparity at, you know, events and public kind of appearances that a lot of LPs on both the bank and non do, where they kind of insist that liquidity is fantastic, and then you know, you have things like this where the clients are saying something very, very different.
Yeah, and you have flash event like we had at the start of January. I look at it and think to myself, you know, it's just marketing spill, because, you know, we did, what, 8 conferences last year. Did anybody at any of those conferences ever say there's a problem with liquidity, in spite of the fact we keep on asking them, we keep on asking, why is it then we are getting these, you know, more of these sharper moves? To me, I think it doesn't surprise me with the JPM survey that they've got this as their highest priority, because a lot of the other stuff that they were talking about, you know, around like, you know, execution ratios and what was the other thing? It was like price consistency and execution quality. Well, without liquidity, you can't do any of that anyway. What was interesting to me is that the other thing as well, just looking at it here, 63% the availability of pricing during volatile markets. I think that's is also that highlights to me that the other thing, the other sort of big misnomer we have in this market is that, oh no, we're always there throughout all these pricing events. Well, if that's the case, why are 63% of people surveyed concerned about the availability of pricing when the markets move? Because if everybody priced the way they said they would, then they wouldn't be an issue. So I think, yeah, I think to me it's good that they're doing these surveys, because, you know, well, we did poke fun at JP Morgan a couple of weeks ago about their analysis of the SMB event. But this to me is a good survey because it does highlight that some of the, you know, misinformation we're getting from the sort of, not so much the LPs, but certainly the platform world.
Here's a question for you. On that, one thing that I was kind of interested is, considering how much we hear about, you know, people kind of really taking risk and kind of not, and market impact, right? And people trying to avoid market impact. To avoid market impact, obviously internalization and being able to internalize flow is one way of achieving that, right? So I was surprised that only 14%, which was out of the ones they listed, that was the lowest, right? 14% of people cited internalization as the most important criteria when selecting a liquidity source. Does that surprise you at all?
It does a little bit. I think it probably
I wouldn't have put it at the top, but I wouldn't have put it that low.
No, I think it probably reflects this. I don't know without sort of really looking at these, I guess, the raw data, the interviews that they had with these, these clients. But to me, I think the reason I would say it's probably lower importance is because when markets do get volatile, you know, just as they're 63% down, you know, saying, well, where's my pricing when it's volatile? And there's, you know, the headline number about, oh, I'm concerned about the, you know, actually getting liquidity. Internalization tends to disappear in volatile markets.
Yeah.
The banks become full broker mode. So I guess internalization as a methodology is really good when the markets aren't, I guess, moving in a trend or, you know, a strong direction. When they're just, you know, binging around in a 5 to 10 point range, then internalization is fantastic. So I guess what that might be a reflection of the client saying, well, actually, yeah, internalization isn't important because when I really need to get the deal done, internalization isn't helping because, you know, frankly, it disappears. You know, it's a physical thing. When everybody sells, the market goes down, and when the market's going down, you can't internalize because there aren't any people buying. So, yeah, I'm with you. I probably would have put it a bit higher than that if you'd have asked me what I expected. I mean, because the interesting thing there is like 37% said response times. Now I'm sort of looking at it thinking, well, if people are still worrying about about response times at a time when, you know, we have most people sort of pricing, I guess, 25 milliseconds, then that tells me that maybe these are the sort of traders, sort of chaps that one doesn't want to deal with all the time because they might be somewhat aggressive in their execution. You know, I spoke to someone 2 days ago, I think it was, and they said, oh, there's banks out there still on 160 millisecond round trip times or hold times with certain clients. And I found that quite staggering in the age of like 5 milliseconds on certain platforms and you know, zero hold times for certain bilateral flow. But I guess it's could also be a reflection of the way that client actually behaves. So,
yeah, Well, I was going to say that the other thing that of the survey, while we're still on the survey, I was surprised by some of the responses regarding the potential of AI and machine learning. So basically, of the survey, 57% of respondents said that they expected AI and machine learning technology to shape the future of trading in a 12-month horizon. It doesn't surprise me that so many people think it's going to have an impact on trading, but I think a 12-month horizon is quite aggressive for some of the technology that is only really starting to come to this market, I thought.
Do you think it's a loose definition of what AI is?
I think that probably explains that number. I think AI can mean a lot of things to a lot of people, and there's a lot of people who say, if they basically automate one process and then just say, oh yeah, we have an AI-based process. Because again, it's buzzwords, right? You get a lot of trading firms who, you know, oh yeah, AI and machine learning focus, quant analytics, you know, takes humans out of the process and we're crunching all this data. But really they're just, you know, like one part of it is the data collection or data analysis is automated and they're calling that AI.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you go back far enough, there's still plenty of people that do it, but you get people that trade back in 1980 on technical analysis, and they would literally have the most enormous pieces of paper all over the wall, and they would draw charts, and they would only trade when the chart gave them a signal. That basically is automated trading back then. Yeah, okay, they had to do it by voice and they had to feel the chart in by hand, but it was data driven because these people never actually said, well, the chart's saying it's, you know, sell, I'm not going to do it. If the chart says sell, they sold. And you know, it wasn't artificial intelligence, but it was systematic. We've had systematic hedge funds for I don't know how long. And what do systematic hedge funds do? They don't give the human being a decision to make. This is what AI does. So I think on one hand, I would say, if it's 57% because people think that we're going to be automating more existing decision-making or support tools or processes, then absolutely, I get it. But if they're actually looking in terms of saying it will actually change how people trade, then I think that's very optimistic. I mean very, very optimistic because...
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, I just think people just don't change that quickly. So one thing with, while we're on sort of liquidity and AI to a degree, moving away from foreign exchange, moving away from fixed income, and moving away from commodities, you know, with nothing if not loose in this place, there was a flash crash on Singapore Exchange equities last week, and it was Jardine Matheson shares dropped to 83%, you know, in a matter of minutes, and then bounced straight back to where they were. I found there was a few interesting things for me in that. That first of all, it was at the pre-open.
Okay.
So in other words, markets weren't open, but people were allowed to trade. But the exchange doesn't have circuit breakers for out-of-hours trading. So I'm kind of get my head around this. I'm thinking, is this something that exchanges should have? Like, you know, if you're allowing people to trade out of hours or to use the, you know, to use the data from out of hours trading to inform their strategies, surely you should have circuit breakers on that. You know, there's always going to be circuit breakers. The other thing that interested me, the exchange came out and said, look, it's not a fat finger. It wasn't a rogue algo. So I'm thinking, well, what is it? Because something caused it. You know, is it just an idiot? And you know, that could easily be the thing. And the exchange didn't cancel any of the sell orders, 83% lower. And I 100% backed them. What bothered me, and this goes back to, I guess, the Swiss National Bank thing, and I didn't hear that much around the sterling flash crash, is that you've got market makers now saying, oh, can we repaper these trades? We didn't mean to sell down there. It's the ultimate in last look. Yeah, maybe last look is getting into equity markets after all. What's your thoughts on this? Because that bothered me, because I'm looking again like, well, I'm sorry, you know, you put the sell order in.
Oh yeah, I think look, if you lost, you lost, and if you won, you won. And if you didn't want to trade there, you shouldn't have traded there. As long as there was no technical malfunction on the exchange, I don't see why people shouldn't be held to what they traded.
No. I think there's a couple of issues for me, a couple of questions that will come up for me from this, and I agree with you 100%. But one of them is a lot of exchanges, and I don't know if this was the case with these market makers, but a lot of the exchanges have like a compulsory element to their market makers. So if you're a market maker, you qualify for certain discounts or rebates, whatever it may be, but you have to keep making a market. Now, that's all well and good, but if you get more of these sort of flash moves, then the market makers inevitably are going to be hurt. Because, you know, the market goes down, they've got to make a market. Their computers, the AI, you know, wannabes, are making these prices based upon last trade. So that perpetuates the move lower. And they have to show a bid and an offer. A lot of the time, they have to show it at a certain spread as well. So the exchanges, and I'm not sure SGX does this. I know other exchanges do. But the exchange is kind of setting them up for a kick-in. The alternative is you turn off your pricing stream. And then that exacerbates the flash crash. So I think there's maybe a question here about, do we need to look at the market maker programs on some of these exchanges just to make sure that it is actually fair for both sides? The other thing is, I think the market was hit by what's called sell-up market orders. And again, this is another sort of, this links back to the AI type thing, because this is where AI decision making would go. The data shows a trade, you know, comes up with a trade, and it just sends the, okay, we're going to sell, so sell at market. The problem is there's no discretion around this. So sell at market, okay, send the order. In the 10 milliseconds it takes for the order to get there, the market's dropped 10%. You sell at market, and that spooks the market maker, and it drops another 10%, and then more strategies come in, and they sort of, you know, and it's all sell at market. So maybe we need to revisit the order type, because I know around the algos in FX, you know, we're doing some work around that at the moment. In the algos, a lot of them have got price limits, as in, yeah, I want to sell this, but if it goes more than like 0.5% or 15 ticks, pull the order. I'm not sure these sell at market orders have this. So I think the other question I would say is, do we need to revisit that order type? Because to me, that's the sort of thing that just exacerbates the move. I mean, it's nonsensical that a firm can go down 83% their share price and come back. They're perfectly okay. You know, as a firm, they're not going broke. I did enjoy one quote. I think it was on Bloomberg, and some bloke from Aberdeen went, yeah, we didn't even bother about it. It's fine. Yeah, liquidity is fine. Yeah. I like your blasé attitude, mate, but one day it might be a bit bigger than that, you know.
I think there's a couple of questions.
Yeah.
I think with the market makers, about the market making program, you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't, right? Because that's one of the complaints we hear in FX, which is, oh, you know, like when it gets stressed, you know, everybody pulls out and there's nothing there. And you know, if there is a quote, it's so wide that it might as well not be there. So that's if you don't have it, everyone says, oh, you know, like, you know, obviously the LPs aren't necessarily, you know, they're under no obligation to jump in front of an oncoming train, so they don't. They get out of the way. But then if you have it, well, then you can have other problems like we've just discussed. So I don't know. I think kind of either way there's going to be issues, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a natural tension that will never be resolved. And I think it's the obligation of the platform or trading venue exchange to make sure it's as fair as possible. And I just wonder if we need to look at it, if this is one of the things we need to look at. I mean, hopefully we'll get some feedback on that. I guess two more points that are loosely related to this. One was, there was a nice sign. JP Morgan puts out regular surveys of their clients. XCX apparently gets Bloomberg to do an editorial for them, because I read the thing there the other day, and it was, you know, they managed to get a client gushing about them. And don't get me wrong, XCX does a good job, but it was quite a gushing article. What was interesting to me was actually the crux of the article was, they're moving into US equities and they're going to try and change the market structure.
I saw that article, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sitting there going, and I read it, and what they're trying to say is right, and I think they're kind of looking at, you know, some of these issues around, you know, order types and trader behaviour, and they were saying, you know, it's too predicated upon speed, which I thought was, you know, was interesting. I also thought it was interesting that Zoran Rolia was now the co-founder of XTX. I'm sure Alex Gurko founded it before Czar came on board, but that's just journalistic license, I suppose. But I think it's going to be really interesting to see how well XTX goes with its lobbying, because I do get the feeling that there's a little bit of a closed shop atmosphere around US equity markets, and that the firms with the power and the money are the market makers at the moment, and they won't want things upset. So yes, in FX, XTX did a good job in terms of disrupting the market to a degree, but they were helped by the banks pulling back, certain banks pulling back. Not the top five or six, but there were definitely 6 to 10 pulled back from their liquidity making provisions and risk taking in the market. I'm not sure that's going to happen in US equities. So that could be something that's worth, you know, interesting to see how they go over the next couple of years with their efforts. And the other observation, I guess, on the SGX thing is a warning to everybody, and this is, you know, Profit and Loss doing its public service broadcasting piece. Japan has announced a 10-day holiday. Yes, folks, you heard me right. 10-day holiday at the end of April, beginning of May, to welcome the new emperor. Given how we have these liquidity issues in FX pre-Japan window and often on Japanese holidays, and given how your Japanese retail punter likes to have a bit of a carry trade on, what chances do you give for there being a flash event or two in that 10-day window? I mean, I think we can only just hope it happens early and clears everybody out, and then we can get back to normal. But, I mean, a 10-day shutdown of the market.
I just hope it happens on when you're at the desk, not me, Colin. I'll be your one to type up.
Yeah, I might have to sleep in that day. Oh, no, sorry, I missed it, yeah. Actually, the clocks would have changed, so it would definitely be my shift and not yours.
Ugh. Yeah. Man.
Yeah. Okay, away from our public service duty, there was some interesting stuff in the volume surveys that came out this week as well. Right on. I mentioned yesterday the voice brokers.
Voice brokers, you needn't have left.
Oh, no, exactly. I dust off my phone.
They lied to you. There was a future for you after all.
I was never a voice broker, mate. I could never do that job. It was way too complex. I'm a simple, it's going up or going down. These guys had to match things and then like look at arbitrages, and they're very bright people, very, very good with numbers. But what was, more seriously, in London, the survey showed that volume through voice brokers went up from, I think it was like 430 billion a day to 604 billion. And I'm going, okay, fine. So clearly things got a lot busier in the forwards, which is normally, you know, an NDFs where these things normally take place. But spot went up by 150%. It went up from 40 yards a day to literally just a couple of yards short of 100 billion a day. It's spot. I mean, I've been ringing around trying to find people to know what's going on, and they're all as mystified as I am. And, you know, I pointed out in my column yesterday, are we missing the trick here? Like, you know, should we all be buying TPI cap and BGC shares? because if their volumes in London have gone up that much, you know, maybe they should have been giving some guidance to the market that actually our Q4 might be pretty good numbers. Or, of course, as someone said to me, someone could have just filled in the form wrong. there's always someone who brings the party down. The only thing I could think of for that was it was people putting fixed volume through the brokers, just try and get a match before the 4 p.m. fix. But we're working on that one. If anyone's got any ideas, again, feedback welcome. The other thing that got me was the RMB. I mean, obviously, we've been talking about this for a while, and it's actually it overtook euro sterling in terms of volume in London. It'd already overtaken euro yen and euro Swiss. I mean, euro Swiss, RMB. I guess we can leave our listeners to fill in their own joke about net market manipulation there, can't we? And the SMB. But that's quite a significant thing. I mean, do you think this is actually like this is a milestone in the RMB's development, or do you think it could just be like a blip?
No, I think it could be. I mean, the sort of the rise of RMB is something that we've documented for some time. Do I think that it's going to consistently rank higher for the next few surveys? I don't know, but I think that over a long enough time horizon, let's say 3 years, that the trajectory is certainly there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it was I think that's probably the most solid number. Two things surprised me, and I spoke to someone yesterday who pointed something else out in the UK survey. But so three kind of like outlier moves, and the RMB to me is the most obvious and most easily explainable, and I think is the one that, as you say, will play out over time. The voice broken, I'm not sure on that could be anything. The other thing was someone got in touch and said, like, did you look at the interdealer direct volumes in NDFs? Basically, so this is trades done between the major banks, actually top 28 banks in London, and it doubled from April to October. So I'm trying to work out why all of a sudden everybody started trading NDFs direct with each other. I don't think markets were particularly volatile, no more than usual. And I thought, banks couldn't even breathe the same oxygen anymore, let alone actually deal with each other. So again, I think there's another little outlier there we could look at and say, is this a question of people allocating wrongly on the report, or is bilateral API stuff being reported by some banks as interdealer direct, which I guess, technically it could be. But I'm wondering whether we need a bit more clarity on how these numbers put together, because that's three things there that surprised me and other people in the market. So
yeah,
I guess everything will be revealed in the next one, because then we get the global survey as well, don't we, for April.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the BIS.
That's not words that you hear very often.
I know, but I'm intrigued to see. I'm intrigued to see, because also, last one was the first time, in 15 years that we had a dip in FX volumes.
Yeah.
So I'll be interested to see. I think I'm pretty confident that the industry will have gone back to growth. But I'm interested. There's always interesting data in there in terms of which segments. Actually seen the real growth.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting because, I guess it depends on market conditions. We can't predict those. If we could, we wouldn't be sitting here boring our listeners. We'd be making billions in the markets. But if it's a reasonably, normal month, then I think I'd undoubtedly there'll be growth. The interesting thing for me will be the role of, other financial institutions, so your asset managers and your hedge funds. Because we've got this stuff about investors are pulling back because they're not sure where markets are going. Will that be reflected if markets are still uncertain in April? I'm with you. I think it will go back to growth. I think it's there was, if I remember rightly, the two surveys ago might have been when it all kicked off in Japan in April 2013. I'm pretty sure something happened, if my memory serves me right. And it all kicked off in Japan, and dollar yen volumes went through the roof. And that kind of created an outlier, which was reflected 3 years later when the volume fell back. So I guess we'll see. To close out, I wanted to get your thoughts on the Standard Chartered got fined $40 million by the DFS this week. You wrote about that. Not so much the fact that a bank got fined by a regulator. Well, whoop-de-whoop.
Yeah.
There was some interesting. You pointed out to me just when we sort of came on 2 minutes before the call started. There was an interesting thing at the end of it.
Yeah. So basically, we've done so many of these. Bank agrees settlement. Bank does fine for FX market manipulation attempts, or alleged, I should say, FX market manipulation attempts. So you kind of go through, you type it all up, that's fine. But it did say at the end that this is the last in the series of consent orders that the DFS is doing following its investigation of manipulation of the FX markets. So we've had CFTC fines, we've now had all the DFS fines, we've had, in New York, fairly recently we had the cartel, the now infamous, cartel group who got acquitted by a jury in New York. It seems from what you've written and what we discussed previously that the Mark Johnson case against him might be wobbling. And I know these aren't all the same instances of stuff, but I can't help but wonder, maybe, just maybe, we're kind of getting to the end of this kind of legal cycle.
Yeah, I love the optimism of youth. I think we are in terms of the regulators. I think you're 100% right. But then, unfortunately, I think you just have to point you to the direction of the fact that, a new group of investors have launched a lawsuit in the US and in Europe. The banks rolled over on the first one and they're probably already regretting it, because trying to work out how they can actually claim it was different with this new group of clients than it was with the last. I think you're right with in terms of the regulators, and particularly if you look at the US, I think now they're looking at again, and the Mark Johnson case kind of is the bellwether for this. The fact that the prosecution kind of changed a few of its arguments tells me that maybe they're starting to realize that their initial thoughts of how the market works are actually not really how it does go. I think the DFS have just run out of people to target, quite frankly. I mean, it would be nice to think it would be. I think the only thing that will bring this to an end is if the banks roll over totally and just pay every client out whatever they want for these alleged misdemeanors. And I think the phrase is neither confirm nor deny the allegations. But I think that's the only way out of this at the moment is if they do settle. Otherwise, we're going to be writing a lot more about, you know, civil lawsuits. We'll end on an optimistic note. I mean, I think hopefully you're right, and I think you're definitely right with the regulators. Let's just hope that, you know, maybe the legal profession starts leaving FX alone and goes to find another easy victim that's in their eyes easy money. So we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for listening. Feedback is always welcome. We've asked quite a few questions this week, and we certainly didn't know the answers to all of them. So if anyone out there does, then always happy to get feedback and responses to that. Have a very good week, and we will speak to you again next week. Thanks for listening.